Yeah. Hello, and welcome to We Heard Wonders, the music podcast that's taking care of business. You're probably wondering, why have we started with Bachman Turner Overdrive? No idea. What we're listening to, what we're chatting about.
Yeah, absolutely no idea.
Quite a tune.
We were clutching in the dark for an intro. I got that phrase into my head for some reason, and it just felt right. So there we go.
I think you thought it was by Outkast. Is that right?
They are very similar, Bachman Turner Overdrive and Outkast.
Pretty similar. Probably this is the one and only time we'll listen to Bachman Turner Overdrive on here, so enjoy it. Enjoy it. How you doing, man?
I'm good, yeah, I'm good. How are you? I see you're in your new location this week.
We've both got new vicinities. Yeah, let me just put this off. That's better. I'm in my new room. Because remember that thrilling moment of podcasting a few weeks ago when we were just two old men moaning about doing DIY?
Yes.
Now I'm in my new podcast location, which is my sort of... I hate using the phrase man cave. That has been bandied around a little bit, but of everyone in the family, I've probably used the room least at the moment. But it's just a sort of room of requirement. So we've got a baby's room up the stairs now. So my podcasting office-y space has moved down here, which is nice.
I must say, from the bit that I can see, it does look quite man cavey.
It does. That's because you can see a dartboard, to be fair.
Yeah. Right, so that's a classic sign of a man cave.
The funny thing is, right, I don't know when exactly I turned into this guy, but I bought the dartboard so I could play darts, right, obviously. And then everyone has become obsessed with darts. Like my two daughters, my son, my partner, my daughter's boyfriend comes around, he loves darts. We're all playing darts, you know, and it's so good for the mental maths. And I'm so sorry that I just said that out loud.
is this like the Luke Littler effect, is it, or is it?
I actually think it is, although I went on a night out to that place in Glasgow, Flight Club, you know, the place where you have like you book a time at a dartboard, and you have drinks and you play dart games. So that I think has really inspired it for me. I don't actually watch darts, so I barely really know who Luke Littler is, really. But he seems like he's quite good at darts, so that's good for him. Well done to him. What have you been up to?
I've just been back at work this week, just trying to readjust to that, really. Nothing too exciting, I'm afraid.
Sucks, doesn't it?
Although I do have tickets to see Jane Weaver next week, so I'm looking forward to that.
Very nice. I'm just talking about your environs. I'm just looking behind you, and I can see that the generic... you had frames, but they didn't have the actual photographs in. They didn't have family photos in. They were just like the sort of holdover images from previously, were they not?
That's true, yeah. So we've actually got people that I know in the frames now, which always helps.
I can see you. You're in one. You're there. That's good.
I need to get a wee picture of you, Ian. Just taking pride of place on the shelf.
On the mantle. And is this your podcast location you're in now, or is this a standby at the moment?
This is a standby until the music room's done. But yeah, I'm quite enjoying it in here.
That's nice.
Quite salubrious.
Salubrious environs. Very good. Right, we're podcasting up a storm this week. We're late. I'm gonna take complete ownership for that.
Sure fault.
It's my fault because we've got the new room, right? And I've like brought the computer down and everything. And then on Tuesday, we were getting ready to do the podcast, and I went, oh, I don't think I've actually connected the computer to the internet in any way or anything like that. So I had to scramble about. I was also trying to do something for work, and I had to scramble about trying to get it organized, and I just didn't get it going fast enough. So here we are, rescheduled, ready to pod.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's plenty to talk about.
There is plenty to talk about. I don't know if we should introduce ourselves anymore. It feels like such an afterthought. But let's do it.
I feel like once we get to this stage, we should maybe just kind of just like let it pass. But why not? My name's Andrew. I buy records and sometimes write about them on Instagram at kidagh86.
Yeah. It's very good. You should go there. My name's Ian. I'm a guitarist in Glasgow band Deadline Shakes, and you can find us on all your social media platforms at Deadline Shakes. I'm also just going to say up front, because I normally leave this at the end of the podcast, but if you do enjoy our pod and you listen to us every week, thank you so much. Please subscribe and give us all the thumbs up and five stars and all that jazz, please. You can follow us on Instagram as well, at We Heard Wonders. If you want to support the podcast, you're probably saying to yourself right now, can I support this podcast financially? And do you know what, Andrew?
What?
They can. They actually can. Yes! They can go to www.buymeacoffee.com/WeHeardWonders. And for the price of an iced white mocha, you can support the ongoing running costs of this podcast. All right. So what we got today?
This week, we've got brand new music from Hannah Francis, Cindy Lee, English Teacher, Shabaka, and Magic Brother and Mystic Sister.
Oh, I like the sound of English Teacher. That's good.
Well, yeah, I mean, it just had to be done, didn't it? You know, given what we do for work, it's just too tempting not to bring it in. So
okay, I will resist. I will continue with this podcast, right? I will, on one condition, right?
Go on.
Because you said Shabaka, right? So we both have to do a Chewbacca impression. Mine is not good. Mine is not good. I'll go first if you want.
Go on, but I can't promise mine will be any better. In fact, I can promise it'll be worse.
Right, I'm gonna just come back from the mic a little bit so I can really give this the full beans. That's what I've got. After you. I'm not sure you've seen Star Wars before. All of a
I opened my mouth and I wasn't expecting something to come out so soon. I surprised myself.
Oh dear. I've injured myself doing that. I've hurt myself. Okay. All right. Anyway, back to serious business. We actually have some absolute tunes tonight as well, so we better get the serious heads on. I will also say in advance that some of these tracks are not on Spotify, so if there's technical gremlins going on here, I apologise. I'll try my best to be as slick as possible. Anyway, Hannah Francis up first.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, here we go.
The brilliance of the day waits for you to wake again. Patient in the way I waited for you.
Home where I live.
was overdriven retro amplifiers, please. That is Bronwyn by Nielsen Trevor Francis. Hannah Francis. Hannah Francis. Man, that's a genre I didn't know was a genre right there. So that's like folk post-rock or something. What are you calling that?
Yeah, there's definitely those elements in there, isn't there? There's that kind of... I mean, she's from Chicago, and there's a lot of that kind of Chicago experimental rock thing going on, kind of the kind of scene that Riley Walker's kind of coming out of, and they're kind of mixing things in the same way that he does. There's kind of, so as you say, kind of elements of like folk, a little bit of prog, a little bit of jazz, as you say, post-rock as well. And yeah, she just does it really, really well, I think. Last week, when you were asking me about my standout releases of the year so far, this was one of the ones that I mentioned, alongside a few others. And it was like the only one that I mentioned that we hadn't played so far on the podcast. So,
so there's me to thank for this one, is what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. So even though this came out like during the period where we were kind of on a break from the podcast. So it came out at the very start of March. But it's so good that I thought, let's bring it in anyway. And after mentioning it last week, yeah, I thought we should share a track from it this week.
It's good because as a song, and as a genre, I mean, it's two genres I know reasonably well, right? Folk and post-rock. I saw someone online call it avant folk, which I thought was quite interesting as a genre. But as a genre I'm not necessarily familiar with, it immediately grabbed me. I just thought, this is really good. Like, this is so like obvious a blend of elements that I'd never thought of them coming together like this before, but it just makes perfect sense. Love the folky, acoustic-y opening. And then when the song opens out and the drums come in and you get the kind of post-rock stuttering drums and all that kind of stuff, it never like takes off into full like heaviness.
No.
But it's tonally quite heavy, I think it has a nice, let's go wanky, chiaroscuro shading, lightness, heaviness thing going on, which I think is really clever. So I really liked it, and I think, I don't know if I'm just predisposed to like things like this. I think I am. I just like, it just grabbed me. First listen, I was like, I love this. This is wonderful. Where's this been forever? What a great idea.
Good. Yeah, I mean, I had a kind of similar reaction to it, really. This is my first kind of introduction to Hannah Francis, but even though it's, you know, she's quite a few albums deep now. I immediately heard this track and just immediately liked it. And this track is kind of instructive of the album as a whole. So you've got like fantastic musicianship, these arrangements that do take these quite surprising and tricksy turns.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite brainy what's going on here, I think.
Yeah.
But while you're
That's
listening
why I like
to
it.
Oh, well, of course. But you know, but it also makes complete sense when you listen to it. It's like it could only go that way kind of thing. And as you say, it's a very kind of novel combination of different things, I think. And it does have a real kind of emotional element to it as well. I think sometimes like post-rock can sometimes be a little bit too cerebral maybe. But this has got a real kind of emotional punch to it, this track and the album as well. And as you say, it's got that kind of richness to the production as well, a real kind of flinty richness that you can tell it's been... I think she recorded this in the woods in Vermont, and you can kind of tell that.
Of course.
I actually thought of you when I was reading about her her artistry, if you like, you know, after we were talking about Daisy Rickman last week. So I've got, as well as being a guitarist and a vocalist, she's a movement artist. So she does a lot of kind of like...
A dancer.
Interpretive dance and things like that, yeah.
Like Napoleon Dynamite or...
Maybe.
Maybe.
Vote for Hannah. she says, as my writing is inextricable from my kinship with the land, I weave ecological imagery and archetype to recount my personal mythology more expansively and more richly. So I thought you'd enjoy that.
And I wish I hadn't heard that.
but yeah, I mean, I think there is, as I say, there is a kind of richness to the production. and lots of really kind of cool ideas, all those kind of finger-picked polyrhythms that are going on. Yeah. There's lovely like woodwinds on other tracks as well. And the lyrics, like, I'm never fully sure what she's singing about. I don't necessarily know who this Bronwyn person is that she's talking about in the track, but as I say, the emotion, you know, pull of the tracks, you know, do work. And
it's funny, for whatever reason, I just didn't think about the lyrics on this particular one. I just let it wash over me. One of the first things I'll do when we're preparing for the podcast is I'll just see if the lyrics list is online. I didn't bother with that. This is going to sound really strange. It never even really occurred to me that there were lyrics in this song. I just was enjoying the wash so much.
Yeah.
And I really loved her voice as well. It's got a really kind of like deep readiness to it. Really folky. Made me think of lots of different people. Like, these are quite diverse influences I'm going to shout here. So like, made me think of Rufus Wainwright, made me think of Jeff Buckley, Fairport Convention, all that kind of random stuff. And it's also quite clever, I think, because there's a lot of like folky stuff around at the moment. We had Adrian Lenker on a few weeks ago and Big Thief and all that kind of stuff. That's in the zeitgeist. But then the post-rock thing is quite a 90s genre, I would say, late 90s, early 2000s genre. And that's quite in. So it's a blending of things that work well primarily, but also potentially are tapping into what musos are going to like, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. But it's not premeditated in that way in any way. It's just...
No, doesn't feel false. No. I might have sounded like I was...
No, you didn't. But I'm just... Yeah, I would just definitely say that that's not the case anyway.
No.
And as I say, it's a wonderful record. It's called Keeper of the Shepherd. And yeah, as I say, it came out on March the 1st. It came out of a period of writer's block for her. And she made this record with a producer and multi-instrumentalist called Kevin Copeland. And yeah, I think what they've produced is something really quite wonderful. And I'd recommend people checking it out.
Yeah, you can have a double recommendation from me as well. That's bloody lovely. That's on my homework list for next week. Now, having said that, you already gave me homework this week. And little did I know, it was a harmless text message you sent me. Here's what you sent, right? You said, I'm just going to get this straight from the horse's mouth. You said, excuse me one second. You said, if you have time, here it is. If you have time, you should dive into the Cindy Lee album because it's really talked about and really reviewed well. It's also not on Spotify, so some extra arrangements required, right? So I thought to myself, oh, okay. Andrew says it's good. I have previously occasionally made the mistake of not jumping in on things when you're saying they're good, like Krangbin, and then now you hate them, so that's so I was like, right, I'll get right on top of this. So I opened this thing up on YouTube. It's like 4 hours long. He's joking, isn't he? So I've listened to bits, but yeah. I'm kind of worried that I'm not listening to the right bits or something. And I read there's obviously this glowing Pitchfork review for Cindy Lee. Cindy Lee's record at the moment. But tell us what's going on with this most zeitgeisty thing.
Yeah, so... it is something that's been talked about and people are kind of getting themselves in a bit of a lather with this. So kind of... music indie fans of a certain vintage, shall we say, and like kind of former blog writers as well are kind of like really getting excited about this record in particular. And it kind of feels like a little bit of a kind of throwback to the kind of blog era of like the 2010s, like kind of late 2000s, 2010s. As you said there, it's been available exclusively on YouTube and GeoCities, which is like a web hosting service that's largely been inactive since 2009.
Yeah.
So again, it's kind of harking back to that time, I guess, in the way that it's been distributed. It's been distributed with a bit kind of minimal marketing, and it has been kind of relying on this word of mouth, and the word of mouth has been insane for this album. Like, people are just getting so excited about it. As you say, it's not 4 hours, it's 2 hours long. 32 tracks, and it is kind of designed to be almost like 16 tracks an hour per CD almost. So you can imagine these being kind of like burned onto a CDR. And I've seen a lot of people like doing that on Twitter. They've been like posting their CDRs. So this is the way that it's supposed to be listened to, kind of thing. So it's all kind of, you know, people are getting nostalgic in that way. And the music itself kind of harks back to that kind of sound, that kind of pitchfork sound, I guess it's kind of not surprising. I mean, pitchfork's not what it was, but this is getting the kind of review and the kind of score that it probably would have got about 10 years ago as well. So it's, yeah, as you say, it's got a kind of glowing 9.1 in Pitchfork, which is the kind of highest score on a Pitchfork review since
for a long time.
The Fiona Apple record, Fetch the Bolt Cutters, from three or four years ago. So yeah, so people are getting really, really excited about this record. I wasn't sure which track to pick. I've just really went for the track that initially kind of grabbed my attention on my first playthrough of it. That's the track that I've chosen. It's called Flesh and Blood. So maybe we could play the track and then maybe talk a bit more about it.
Perfect. You've set us right up. Here we go.
Definitely talk more about it.
Yeah. Thank you. Right. So there's Flesh and Blood by Cindy Lee. I want to tell you straight, right? I'm in kind of a magic place with this record right now, where if you were to say to me, well, first of all, it's presented as a 2-hour thing on YouTube with no track breaks. So if you were to say to me, what track do you like? I'm like, I don't even know. Like the one with the singing in that and the one with the guitar solos and stuff. I don't know. And I also don't know what it is specifically about this that is so unbelievably charming and disarming. The whole thing is so good. It just like, I don't know, cajoles you in. And it's almost like the Pitchfork review, which you referred to there, says a brilliant thing, which is like, it's very Spartan. It's almost like what's not in it as much as what's in it. And if you kind of just squint your eyes a little bit, you can almost hear more than is there.
Yeah.
It lets you imagine. It lets you think about all the opportunities. And there's so many interesting things to say about this, but I just wanted to come out and say that I'm at a really interesting point with this music where I actually don't really know what I'm going to say about it. I don't really know what's going to come out of my mouth next. I just know that I really, really like this. And I'll try and do my best in the next couple of minutes to, like, I'll try and make sense of it for myself, and then I'll try and pass on what I think here to the podcast. Tell us more, Andrew.
No, that's really cool. To be honest, I wasn't sure how you would react to this because it's quite, you know, relatively lo-fi. Mm. And I wasn't sure if you would maybe just be, you know, you would just kind of immediately kind of dismiss it for that, or it just, you know, it just would just kind of sound a little bit kind of limp or something like that. I don't know. I shouldn't be like presumptuous, but I wasn't sure like where you would kind of land on it. I mean, for me, yes, certainly. I mean, that's charms definitely a word. Like it's incredibly charming. I mean, it's lo-fi, but it's kind of deliberately so. It's not, you know, sometimes lo-fi can mean that it's just kind of poorly produced or not, you know, kind of, yeah, just not enough thoughts have gone into it. But I think this is a kind of deliberate choice. You know, he's deliberately going for this kit. They're going for this kind of like deliberately kind of woozy dreamland almost. And so many times I've went onto that YouTube link and I've kind of aimed just to kind of play one or two tracks. And you just get sucked in. To the world of it, and you end up playing a massive chunk. You know, kind of emerge 40 minutes later, and you've kind of listened to a good chunk of the record. But yeah, it's just a kind of record to kind of lose yourself in.
Definitely. May I make a horrible confession, which is that when I'm working and I need to concentrate, I'll often go onto YouTube and I'll just type in things like study music or cam music or piano music or whatever, or classical guitar relaxation or whatever, right? And I'll deliberately put on music that I don't really care about all that much, just to sort of blot out the rest of the world around me, and I can just concentrate on what I'm doing. Now, what I'll do is I'll just stick that on in the background. In the last couple of days, I've been doing that with this, right? I'll just like go like 40 minutes in and plonk and hit play, right? I'm struggling to explain it. There's just something so whimsical and kind of magical about the whole thing. It's got, I think because it's lo-fi, it has a kind of naivety to it.
Yes.
And we'll talk about that on this track in a wee minute, I'm sure. But like there's a kind of like simplicity to it that makes it very easy to listen to. But at the same time, it's quite a challenging listen as well if you're really listening. There's lots to focus on and think about. So yeah, the track Flesh and Blood, I think, is a good selection. I think it's somewhat representative of some of what you hear on this record, although it's quite a broad spectrum. And you can probably list quite quickly every sound you hear on this track. So there's bass guitar, there's some electric guitar, there's some drums, there's a low-end vocal, there's a falsetto, there's a bass guitar. I can't remember if I said synth or not, but if I haven't said synth as well, that's it, isn't it? I don't think there's anything else that I'm particularly missing. Anything significant anyway. And I think it's clever for that. And the highly rigid rhythmic nature of it comes across straight away in the track, and it goes on like that for a couple of minutes. And there's a few moments when it just feels like it's going to lose its way. The timing's going to just slip out slightly. And then in a moment of really clever stuff, this isn't going to, when I say this is going to sound shit, it sounded better when I listened to the track, but it just speeds up. Like, I don't know when, somewhere in there, it just speeds up. I'm going to mention my favourite musician, Joshua Homme. He detests playing with metronomes, detests it. Live, he says, you know, if we have a drummer and the drummer starts playing faster, we play faster. Like, that's rock and roll. That's what you're supposed to do. It's not supposed to be metronomic to that extent. It's supposed to be... So even though it's a metronomic regular rhythm, they let it speed up. And then, towards the end, the drums fall down a hole or something.
Yeah, just collapse in on themselves,
or it becomes a tiny kit or something. I don't really know what's going on there. And it sounds like a corridor, and it sounds like you're walking down a corridor of a music studio, and you can hear a band rehearsing next door or something. It sounds a little bit like that. And on that particular anecdote about walking down a studio and hearing a band rehearsing, I find the music quite evocative. Good, I've landed on something. I find it really evocative. It reminds me of that, and it reminds me as well of being really young. Like, I don't know exactly what age, but when I was just getting into playing guitar and stuff, and I had little recording machines and stuff, and I had little drum machines and things, and you were making your first attempts at not really trying to work on making an amazing song, but just like, how do I record anything? Like, how do I get anything onto tape? And how do I add other stuff on top? And you would often go for like really simple ideas that lasted like 20 bars or something, and then you would just like go and flip by, and I'll add a guitar solo on now, and I'll sing about on top and all that. So it's really evocative to me of my childhood, basically, this particular track. So there we go. I landed on something that I liked that I actually didn't think of, so that's good.
Oh, I like it. I mean, on my first play for this track just kind of felt like the anthem on the record. It could be in somebody else's hands if it was kind of built up a little bit more or kind of constructed in a slightly different way. It could be this kind of big rock anthem almost.
Yeah.
But he's kind of making some unusual, they're making some unusual decisions and unusual choices. And it's just got a, it's just, as you say, it's just got a real kind of charm to it, I think. And across the record, there's just so many different genres that are pulling from. They're kind of pulling from a lot of that kind of classic doo-wop and bro-building songwriting. So I think that's maybe something when you're talking about the kind of nostalgia of it, but also the charm of it and the kind of immediacy of it as well. It's kind of, they're kind of using a lot of those kind of classic rock structures and pop structures, but just bringing in a lot of kind of interesting guitar effects as well, a lot of kind of interesting production touches. And it just creates this really cool, as I say, woozy, hypnagogic is the word that's been used a lot to describe it. And yeah, it's kind of got that kind of Lynchian thing as well. Yeah, kind of, I'm stepping into like a David Lynch film or something like that. But yeah, I just really, really enjoy it. And I think it does, it's just that kind of nostalgia that you're talking about as well. I think, as I say, it's just a kind of certain kind of indie fan is just really responding to that kind of nostalgic element of it, as well as just the quality of the songs and the whole package, really, I think. Yeah, and it's just a really kind of cool, as I say, kind of word of mouth story, really, that's just kind of come out of nowhere, and it's just really kind of gained traction. And you know, now you've got this Pitchfork review as well that's going to make it reach more ears as well, and there is a vinyl coming. They're on tour just now, and apparently, like, once the tour's finished, they're going to press up quite a few copies on vinyl. So I'm sure that'll sell really, really well.
It's so cool how there's no shits given here for the music industry in any way. Like, it's literally like trying. I actually don't know. Is this like marketing genius where it's like, to just have gone around the traditional paths required to launch an album? So much so that it's garnered all this really good will and word of mouth and all that sort of stuff, to the point where now a physical release makes a lot more sense. Or is it just, you know, we don't give a shit about any of that. just going to pop out on YouTube and GeoCities because that's a laugh. I'd like to retcon now that we just did Bachman Turner Overdrive at the start of the podcast just because we just felt like it, you know, indie, indie in that. But yeah, so is it like a sort of marketing genius thing, or is it a you know, just a happenstance, you know, a happy accident kind of thing? Who knows? Does it matter? Not really, probably. I will return to the YouTube video and say that if you read the comments underneath, they are like overwhelmingly positive. And we're on a single track here, YouTube videos. This is not the official channel. But here are just some of the comments under here, right? This is so good and I can't believe it. Such a massive tune. Favorite song of the album so far, album of the year, and so on and so on and so on. So like it is a crowd pleaser. And that, yeah, I think, is another thing that I'm just like, I like it, right? And so that's fine. But I don't understand why it's so popular. Like it's really tapped into something. So there we go.
Yeah.
Well done.
As I say, it's just really found its audience. There's a comment underneath the link for the album. It goes something like, it sounds like nothing I've ever heard, but everything I've always loved. Something like that. And it's kind of got that to it. So there's a lot of kind of elements of, as I say, things like the kind of broad building pop and doo-wop and the Velvet Underground, Galaxy 500. A lot of that kind of 2010s indie, things like Deer Hunter and Unknown Motor Orchestra and things like that. So there's a lot of those things in there. But it just doesn't sound exactly like that. We haven't really said... Go on.
My indie palette isn't as broad as yours, so I was probably thinking like Velvet Underground. I was thinking Belle and Sebastian, early Belle and Sebastian. Glaswegians love a bit of lo-fi indie, don't we, really? We're into absolutely a bit of that.
Yeah, absolutely. We haven't really said who Cindy Lee is yet. So Cindy Lee is the glammed up alter ego of Canadian songwriter, guitarist, and drag performer Patrick Flegel. And they were previously the front person of a group called Women, who were this cool post-punk band of the late 2000s, who had a couple of really kind of critically acclaimed records. But then the band kind of fell out. One of the other members of the group passed away as well, and then that kind of led to that group breaking up. So then you had Patrick going one way, and you had some of the other bandmates going on to form a group called Preoccupations, who are quite a cool act as well, that I'd recommend people checking out if you don't know them. But then, yeah, so since then, Patrick's made several records as Cindy Lee, and they kind of have gone that kind of more traditional way of just kind of, you know, releasing records and through a record label and things like that. So they kind of clearly have deliberately tried to do something a little bit different here. And as you say, it just seems to really kind of pay dividends. And they're getting more attention than they ever have. So, yeah, fair play. And I think the record really kind of backs up. And it's just one of those ones. I think the phrase I used for you was, you try and dive into it if you get a chance. And it's just one of those ones that you can just dive into. There's just, it's just a kind of, you know, it's just the treasure trove of tunes and styles and things to kind of latch onto. And every time that I've gone back to the record, you get more highlights. And you notice more things. So it's just, I think it's just one of those ones that's going to continue to grow throughout the year, really.
Well, I'm gonna catch your mixed metaphor of diving into a treasure trove and say that I did dive in, and then I was a little bit worried that I was going to be drowning because it's so massive and there's so much to grab hold of. And then it felt just like a gentle, you know, a gentle backstroke, mm-hmm. breaststroke. Those are two obviously very different swimming maneuvers, I understand. But yeah, it felt like very quickly I was like, oh, no, I do get this. And I even understand why it's so massive. Read somewhere online that the whole record and the whole concept has been floating around now for, not the whole record, but parts of the record and the concept have been floating around for about 4 years. So it's a cumulative process as opposed mm-hmm. to like this was all recorded 2 months ago or whatever, which I also think is cool, you know. At what point did Cindy Lee go, right, that's me recorded 30 tracks now. So just two more to go. Let's get these in here. I like it. I wonder as well about these are genuine thoughts I've been having over the last couple of days. Like, how do you decide what order they go in?
Yeah.
You know, like I've made two records with my band, and the order of things, it was something we debated as if it was like life and death. Like, if we put that one there, then you can't put that one there, so you have to do the other thing and blah blah blah. We actually wrote music to join things together and, you know, to yeah, lay things out. So I like the idea of this being a big, just being a big blob, like a big like stash of tracks, and then it has it been artfully put together. Yeah, I think there's an intro. I think it been artfully put together, or is it just like these are the order they were recorded in, or what? I don't know. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I think it kind of has a mixed up logic to it. The way that they've divided up the two CDs, if you like, the 16 tracks and the 16 tracks, the two sides end with these long, lovely instrumental pieces that almost kind of serve as a, almost like a kind of end credits to each side. That are really, really nice. So I think that there is a little bit of thought to it, but as you say, you could potentially just, you know, click 30 minutes in on the YouTube link, and you would, you know, you're gonna find a good track, and then you're gonna enjoy a nice portion of the record.
I think it invites that. I think it invites you to do that because it's not presented in a traditional record format. I've not been to the GeoCities site because it's 2024, so I haven't done that. But you know, you said GeoCities went out of business in 2009, and I was like, yeah, but nobody used it for the 10 years
right
prior to that. Like, it really finished in the late 90s. Anyway, right, I'm conscious now that we've been podcasting for like 45 minutes for two tracks in, so we probably should move on. I think we could probably talk about this a lot more. Actually, we probably should have just had five tracks from this record. Could have done it. And we'd probably barely have scraped the surface as well. Anyway, I think we're both saying this is potentially got legs, and it's probably going to be considered, you know, it's probably going to be up there on folks' album the year list and all that sort of stuff. So if you haven't got into it yet, if you haven't heard of it, now's just probably as good a time as any.
Definitely.
Yes, dive into this treasure show before that plane sails. Okay. speaking of similes and whatnot and mixed metaphors, here are English teacher with their track Nearly Daffodils.
Mostly it feels like a waste. So much laughter uncanned. I've forgotten the taste that made me go back. All the plans were tiptoed around. Quiet hours, daffodil buds. There is a reason the first 9 months doesn't count. Nearly. Scared of being under. I started whistling in the mornings. I like to hear the birds sing. so much laughter uncanned. I've forgotten the taste, don't make me nearly daffodils. Nearly daffodils. Last night I dreamt that we lasted all the way till spring, but now the fields are full of red and blue with nothing in between. You can lead water to the daffodils, but you can't make them drink.
Ah, man. The abrupt stop at the end. Love it. Like, English teacher. First of all, they're called English teacher, so you and I are predisposed to like them. We've never outwardly said exactly what we do for a living on here, but this is a cool name for a band, right?
Yeah, fact, absolutely. Fact. This is a cool name, guys. This is a really cool name.
Shakespeare and that.
Anybody who does this or is involved with it in any way has got to be cool, yeah?
Well, not everyone. I mean, we're all right, but like...
Oh, yeah. Well, we could tell you some stories.
That's another podcast entirely. But listen, there's so much to like about this. It's like brimming with that kind of like, you know, what I'll say, I'll just say something ageist real fast, right? Is because I listened to this track and then I looked at pictures of the people who recorded it and I went, I knew you were going to look like that. I knew you were going to be 20. And 19 and things, I knew it because it was just so filled with like enthusiasm, and it's like a really irrepressible track. This one, it's got that. I remember them. I literally remember being in bands doing that, like you know, trying to do everything all at once in one track. And I'd say this comes off quite well. I really like this. I bet they would be really cool to see live. I bet they're the type of band that when they play live, they all look like really bored. Like they're just like, oh, do we have to? But inside, they're really enjoying themselves. I want to say enthusiastic things about this, so I'll let you maybe calm me down first, and then I'll come back at it again.
Okay, yeah. So I'll give you just a little bit of background about who they are. I mean, you, as you say, they are kind of very young, sickeningly young, and. They're young as a group as well. They only formed in 2020. So they're a British group from Leeds, consisting of vocalist Lily Fontaine, guitarist Lewis Whiting, drummer Douglas Frost, and bassist Nicholas Eden. And this is from their just released debut album, which is called This Could Be Texas, which has came out via Island Records. So they are on a major label. Which is quite impressive for such a young group. Home to Last Dinner Party as well, who we talked about before. So I think they've kind of got that. There's a little bit of that. The kind of we could say maybe whether you think they're better or not. But yeah, there's something about that kind of youthful, well produced, major label backing, but also quite cool and. Quite contemporary as well. This track was released last year. It was one of Time Magazine's top 10 tracks of the year.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good for them.
So, yeah, absolutely. So this track's been a bit a while, but it's one of my favourites on the album. So, and it's kind of illustrative of what they do, so I thought it'd be good to bring it in.
Yeah. No, I won't wax lyrical. No, sorry. I thought it was my time. I'm so like buzzing to talk about it.
No, you can. You can.
Well,
go for it.
Well, do you know the first band that went through my head when I listened to this track is not particularly a cool one, actually. It's Maximal Park.
Mm-hmm.
Did they make you think of Maximal Park as well?
I can definitely see that. Yeah, absolutely.
Just with that sort of like twitchy energy and then the attempt to put these like quite erudite lyrics over the top. And there was a time when Maximal Park were like really, really hitting it, all the things that people liked in terms of indie, they were doing it. And it got a bit much afterwards. But this does a lot of that stuff. And I'd say there's a few diverse influences in here. I don't know to what extent they like math rock, whether they like Tool or not, I don't know. But there's definitely that sort of like the bass, which is sort of going all twitching all over the place. And there's a breakdown in the middle where there's a really mathsy kind of riff going on over the top.
Mm-hmm.
Special shout out to two things which I really, really enjoyed. One is the singer, was it Lily Fontaine, did you say?
Yeah.
Love her kind of deadpan delivery in the verses. The lead's accent, I think, really really comes across really well here. The lyrics are great. Every lyric is brilliant. It's really, really whip sharp. Lots of ideas of things that aren't quite there, but you'd like them to be, you know? Like, obviously, Nearly Daffodils, but, like, the idea of, you know, where is it? Sometimes it tears like a freight train through a christening, displacing the new growth and making everything ugly. And then there is a reason the first 9 months don't count. Are lyrics about, like, you know, about things not, you know, you wish for something, you want for something, but it doesn't come the way it doesn't happen the way you think it will. And then of course the chorus or the refrain, nearly Presky, wait, no, almost, no, daffodils. Brilliant. And there's a really, and this is my second thing, and then I'm going to stop babbling, but I'm really enjoying this. Are the links to like poetry and artistry? So Daffodils obviously makes you think of, well, it makes me think of William Wordsworth. If this band is called English Teacher, I'm going to say Daffodils by William Wordsworth. But it makes me think of art as well, because the record sleeve. Now, is that the sleeve with the painting, with the sheep, with the object on top, is that the single cover or is it the album cover?
That's the album cover.
The album cover, right. It's really reminiscent of the American painter Georgia O'Keeffe. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Georgia O'Keeffe, Andrew. But Georgia O'Keeffe paints these like beautiful, desolate American desert scenes. And then right in the center of the image paints like an animal skull, like right out of, like it shouldn't be there. It's like incorrect in terms of, you know, perspective or whatever. And they're like hyper-realistic animal skulls on top of these like desert scenes. And that's almost exactly what their single cover is, although it looks really quaint and English as opposed to the American Texan background. And what was the name of the record?
The record is... Sorry, This Could Be Texas.
This Could Be Texas. So there's, again, there that idea of not quite, but nearly, the near-miss kind of thing. There's parts of the track that I think don't work particularly well. It's not 100% for me. Like, I think the sort of shouty segment towards the end, I'm not super as into that. I liked it when it was more pegged in and more narrow. But on the whole, I've talked a lot about this one, but on the whole, this is a 10 out of 10 for me. This is brilliant.
Good. Yeah, I'm really pleased. Yeah, I'm really enjoying the record, actually. The album's very good, I'd say, especially for a debut. Really inventive, lots of variety, some really, really good choruses on the record. Anybody that listens to Six Music will have heard a few of the singles from this. There's one called The World's Largest Paving Slab. That's sort of thing that they do well, is like they've got a really, again, for the English teacher thing, it's that they've got a really kind of good ear for titles as well. So there was a previous title, I think it was Yorkshire Tapas was one. there's a track called Mastermind Specialism where they kind of talk about how they haven't quite found their thing in life yet. But they kind of like reel off a lot of these, kind of cultural touchstones, I guess. Through that track, it's interesting as well because they've kind of got an uneasy relationship with that phrase post-punk. You know, you might mention Maximo Park. They kind of get called a post-punk group quite a lot, but they kind of feel like they're a lot more than that, and I can kind of see that. I mean, a lot of those kind of groups that they're starting to kind of get bunched in with, I find a little bit kind of tiresome. You're kind of like dry cleaning the yard act and people like that kind of, like, kind of morose or bored vocals over serrated guitars. I find it a little bit boring a lot of the time, but I think they, as you say, they've got a real kind of vim to them. There's a real kind of catharsis to a lot of their tracks as well, which I enjoy. And it's interesting as well because Fontaine's a mixed race. There's a track called R&B, which says, despite appearances, I haven't got the voice for R&B. and she's kind of like playing with like kind of you know, perceptions of what the band should be and how yep. they should sound. There's a cool quote from her. She says, when people ask where I'm from, I usually say I'm mixed race, half Yorkshire, half Lancashire. it's pretty cool. As I say, it's a really good record. There's a real kind of sense of catharsis. There's a track called Side Boob, which is a lot more emotive than a track called Side Boob has any right to be.
Yeah.
I just think it's a really, really good record, actually. Really strong debut.
Yeah. Okay. And as soon as you said Side Boob and it's more emotive, I had to delete 10 quips. 10 quips deleted. So English Teacher, wow. That also takes me back. That's also evocative of like a different time period. You know, the indie period we talk about when everyone was called the something or other. Brilliant. Like, it's great. I think they're so cool. Hopefully they get a massive following. I've forgotten the name of the other band, the arch pop band that are under same, that you know, you said were kind of label mates with.
Last Dinner Party. Them.
Yeah, not into that. That's too, to me, that's too contrived in a way and not half as clever as it thinks it is.
Yeah.
Whereas this presents itself just face on, like, I'm just going to tell you some lyrics here. Here they are in my Yorkshire accent. And they're so smart. And it's just the sort of the deadpan delivery of them, I think, is brilliant. Makes you think of all kinds of classic English bands. Even, and I don't know if they would like this very much, but even early Arctic Monkeys a little bit, with some of the energy and some of the sort of cleverness. But I would say this is even a category beyond that in terms of cleverness. Brilliant. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you. Maybe if bands want praised on our podcast, they should do more of naming themselves after what we are. So, like, English Teacher, right? Mm. That's what we are, right? Nearly 40 is another one. You know? Tired would be one. Would you like to offer any?
Deadline Shakes Guitarist.
Deadline Shakes Guitarist. If a band came out called Deadline Shakes Guitarist, like I would be properly thinking they're the best band ever. What about Instagram Vinyl Specialist? How would that be?
Oh, they would definitely get featured on my Instagram.
Fantastic. All right, so that's a new band. But next we've got Shabaka, who I believe is one of the Sons of Kemet.
He is, yeah, among many other things.
And other things. I don't know if we've specifically had Sons of Kemet on the podcast before, have we? Or have we just talked about them?
We just talked about them, mainly in relation to Tom Skinner, who is, of course, now with The Smile. Mm-hmm. But yeah, absolutely, yes. But yeah, Shabaka Hutchins, primarily known as a saxophonist for a range of projects, including Sons of Kemet, The Comet is Coming. It was like a kind of raved up jazz, interstellar jazz type project. And then there was Shabaka and the Ancestors as well, that was going in more of a kind of spiritual jazz direction. But yeah, as I say, always as a saxophonist, really. But he talked about the fact that he became kind of like burned out, I guess, you know, playing with that kind of sense of intensity and conviction every night on stage. It was just kind of taking its toll, I think. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of turned his hand to the clarinet, which is, I think, was his kind of first instrument of choice. And he's also working with a range of other woodwinds and flutes on this new record. What would you say is the most kind of punishing instrument to play? I was thinking that the saxophone must be up there in terms of, you know, the kind of breath that is taken out of you, literally taken out of you.
I don't know because I think he plays alto sax or tenor sax, so they're not massive I don't want to come across as some sort of like saxophone expert here, but I have grown up in a household with my father, who is a saxophone player, and he has a large range of saxophones, including one which I think is called a bass sax, which would take up approximately half of the room that I'm in. So yeah, I know what you mean though. Like brass instruments and instruments that involve breathing into them generally, I think probably are quite tricky, especially if you're doing something a little bit jazzy. Special note to the clarinet though. The clarinet was actually the first instrument I ever played. I also grew up in a household with a clarinet jazz enthusiast, also my dad. So clarinet was the first instrument I ever played. And I'll just share a quick clarinet anecdote with you, if that's all right, before we kick this track off. So basically, I don't know if it's a sort of hero worship thing, but like when I was offered the opportunity to learn clarinet at school, I thought, oh, my dad plays clarinet. I should learn how to play clarinet. Girls will love it, you know. that element of it didn't really work out. But anyway, so I tried, right, and I basically hated it from the very moment. Like as soon as I've like you put the thing in your mouth and it's like the wood on your tongue, I just didn't like the sensation of it. I just didn't like how it felt. I was crap at it as well. Like I had no great aptitude for it. And it was actually that spurred me on to play the guitar, because like I just thought I'm not good at this, but I do like music, and I did like being in the big school band or whatever. But the final nail in the coffin was, right, I don't know if you ever had an experience like this with your parents, where I was growing up and like every time I had to like go to clarinet practice or whatever, I'd be like getting forced in, like boot in the back, you know, like getting kicked in the door kind of thing. I hated it, complained about it, jumped up and down, screamed about it. And they kept saying, no, you've made a commitment to this now. You know, what, why the parents say this shit, I don't know. But they were like, you've made a commitment to the clarinet and you've made a commitment to the teacher, right? They're paying the teacher specifically to teach this. You have to keep going at least until, and then there was some arbitrary point, right? So there was a school concert about a month before this arbitrary point, right? So I'm sitting there and I don't know how to play the music that the band are playing, right? I'm really, really bad at it. I'm sitting kind of hunched over playing the clarinet. And afterwards, the music teacher came up to me and she just went, your posture was awful. That's all she said. And I just, I mean, I was only like 12 at the time, so I wouldn't have actually said this out loud, but in my head, I just went, fuck you. And that's clarinet finished. I almost literally never played the clarinet again, ever. Like, I almost literally never, ever put it to my lips again, because she said, your posture was awful. I was like, oh, I hate you. I'm out.
Just not even any kind of like notes about how maybe to make your posture better. Just yeah.
And that, as you know, given the profession that we have, is not the way things are done.
No.
Okay, I've taken us too far away from Shabaka and floating points and Larrigy, but it was worth it, I think. Maybe, I don't know. Okay, this track is long. What are we clocking in about 8 minutes here?
Yeah. Hopefully this will chill you out a bit, Ian, after the trauma of that room.
I know. Every now and again, I have one of these little flashbacks back to like some not very traumatic childhood experience that I have overthought over time. More to come, podcast listeners. Anyway, so this track is called I'll Do Whatever You Want and is by Shabaka. Here we go. Thank you. Alrighty, so that is Chewbacca with I'll Do Whatever You Want, which is quite an ironic name for a track on which he basically does whatever he wants. You know, it's just kind of, you think it's like one thing, and then he just kind of starts sort of muttering towards the end. It's got a kind of mouth music-y element towards the end. It is very chill, that, isn't it? Overall,
I would say. It is. It takes you on a wee chill journey. That's actually Laraji at the end that's doing that. Ah. That's doing that muttering. So he's like an ambient pioneer, would say. He's a bit of a legend in the kind of ambient music. And one of the things that he believes in is the transformative power of laughter. And he does these kind of like laughter meditations. So I think that's what you're hearing there at the end.
Yeah,
it's a little bit of that, and it kind of, I don't know, it kind of works as like a kind of coda for the track, I guess. It kind of brings it to a place of rest after what is a kind of bit of a journey, a bit of a kind of steady build throughout the track.
Yeah,
but no, I mean, I really enjoy this track. I'm really enjoying the album as well. You mentioned Outkast at the start of the show, so you're trying to think of an Outkast track to maybe start the pod with, and the connection there is obviously while we had our break from podding, one of the most unexpected records of last year came out, which was Andre 3000's ambient flute record,
Opus
is 90 minute Opus. I mean, that was a really kind of interesting project. It was one of those ones that was maybe a little bit more exciting and intriguing in concept and anticipation rather than the record itself, I would suggest.
Yeah.
But yeah, really kind of interesting. And that was the sound of Andre 3000 kind of really kind of, you know, finding a kind of new passion, I guess. And there was something very kind of tentative, but also kind of charming about the way that he played flute on that record, and he surrounded himself with amazing players. So there's a guy called Carlos Nino, who was a kind of key collaborator on that record and kind of gave a lot of the kind of spacey production touches that really kind of made that record what it was. And kind of did a lot of kind of heavy lifting in terms of the scene setting. But I don't think I'll be returning to that Andre 3000 record when there are kind of artists kind of like...
That's a polite way of putting it.
It's bit when there's artists like Carlos Nino and Chewbacca Hutchins that are kind of working in that kind of lane, but they're kind of a lot more kind of musically competent, I think it's fair to say, in terms of when they're playing the flute.
If you have the choice of listening to Andre 3000's flute music or, I don't know, Stankonia by Outkast, there's only really one winner there, isn't it? You know, it's the sort of ridiculous final point of the phrase, I liked his earlier stuff. You know what I mean? Like, it's a wee bit like, I think as well, Andre 3000's flute record is a little bit like Smokey Robinson's Gasms record. It's like he's finally found his calling in life. You know, it's what he's always really wanted to make.
Tracks in My Tears was just a kind of build up to that's a
I'm sorry, because there's no way to talk about the Smokey Robinson Gasms thing without just everything becoming an innuendo. So we'll just have to pop that down over there. And walk away from it and come back to this track. But this track is really, like, it's surprisingly guitar-y. I thought there's like quite a lot of guitar playing in it.
Yeah.
It's one of those tracks that's like, it's almost like I can't sort of work out how it's like what's holding it together? Like, what's the through line or the thought process? And I guess that's because there kind of isn't really one, deliberately so. Things weave and you know, there's almost a sound like of like a, there's like a big cat growling in the background somewhere towards the end of the track. I don't know if you've caught that. I'm not sure what that means. That might have been Larrigy, to be honest.
I think it probably was.
Yeah. Oh, he gets in about it, Larrigy, doesn't he? But the floating points influence I thought was there with the sort of rhythmic stuff at the beginning. That very fine Floating Points record from a few years ago, which was one of your albums of the year. Or was it your album of the year? Or was it just one of your albums of the year?
I think it was second, yeah.
Second,
but it's interesting you mention that, because that's actually how, I don't know if it's how they met, but they certainly previously collaborated. It was last September, there was a one-off live version of, or a live performance of that Promises record performed at the Hollywood Bowl. And it was Shebaka Hutchins took the place, if you like, of Pharoah Sanders, who'd passed away.
Did they?
Yeah, in between the record coming out and that performance. So it was Hutchins was doing the Sanders parts. So that seems like a kind of key collaboration. I don't know. I think that's maybe where this collaboration has come out of.
Yeah.
When I was talking about the Andre 3000 record, there's a lot of the same players that were on that Andre 3000 record that are kind of dotted about this record as well. So I know on Spotify you'll see for this track it's featuring Floating Points and Larrigy, but there's like it's kind of like a who's who. Yeah. Of people on this record, on this track in particular. So you've got Esperanza Spalding, Carlos Nino, who I mentioned already. He's got these kind of signature bells and whistles all the way through this track. There's Tom Herbert, who's this really kind of interesting avant classical performer. And the guy that's doing that twitchy guitar is a guy called Dave Okumu, who's in the band The Invisible, and he also does a lot of stuff with like Jesse Ware and people like that. Amazing producer. So and Andre 3000 is actually on this track as well, playing some kind of strange flute.
Yes. Now can we just pause again? Sorry, this is one of those records where, despite the musical quality of it, I do just get obsessed with some of the silly details.
Yeah.
So Andre 3000 is playing the Teotihuacan drone flute.
Yeah.
Have you Googled it at all, Andrew?
I haven't had the pleasure.
Right. I will say it is it's kind of an odd looking flute. That's what I'm gonna say. I'll leave it there. It's an odd looking flute. That's all I'm willing to say on the matter right now. It's like when you said something earlier on, I was like, I have to delete several thoughts. Well, I've done that there. I'll just leave that as a tantalizing thought for everyone. The Teotihuacan drone flute is an odd looking instrument, shall we say.
That's fair. I think this track, in terms of the album, the album's again quite a varied record. There's bits that are very kind of ambient. This one, I guess, with the Floating Points influence, it's no surprise that it is the kind of most electronic sounding thing on the record. There's kind of spoken word bits, there's hip-hop artists kind of do their thing over some of the tracks as well. There's a lovely track with Moses Sumney, who's somebody who I love, and I really want a new Moses Sumney record sometime soon. But he does a really lovely track where he's kind of doing this kind of scatting thing in kind of collaboration with Shebaka's flute. It's really lovely. There's some tracks that are really kind of lushly produced and orchestrated, and there's others that are a bit more meditative and ambient. So it's a lovely record, and I think this track's kind of ideally positioned. I think it's track 7 on the record, and it's just kind of providing that sense of a journey at the stage in the record where you kind of want that and you want to kind of stretch out a little bit. So I think it kind of works within the album really well, this track. I think in terms of like jazz records that I've heard more recently, this is one of the strongest ones. And it's cool to hear Shebaka Hutchins doing something different, because He was never going to get typecast because he was doing like so many different things with his different projects, but it's cool to hear him doing something completely different with this album. And it does seem like, you know, there's a lot of kind of this kind of like jazz adjacent stuff, a lot of kind of new age ambient type stuff that seems to be really appealing to people in a kind of noisy, overwhelming modern world, I guess. It just seems to be kind of having a moment. And this is a really good album.
That makes a lot of sense. So it's loads. It's like every cool person is on this. You know, it's a big collaboration. Yeah. And as you say, it's a kind of a balm to a difficult, noisy, busy world.
Yeah.
Cool.
And the album's called "It's Perceive Its Beauty, Acknowledge Its Grace."
I really like the album title. Actually,
it's a lovely title.
Good title. Okay, so that takes us to our fifth new track of the day. I've been on a bit of a random thing tonight, I guess. I've just been sort of all over the place. Maybe it's tiredness, maybe it's inspiration, who knows. But as soon as I saw the title of this track and the name of the artist, so the title is The Fool by Magic Brother and Mystic Sister, it made me immediately think of one of my favourite fantasy novel series, the first book is called Assassin's Apprentice by Robin Hobb, and our main character is the Fool, and fools are like really important characters in fantasy fiction. I'm not sure to what extent you like fantasy fiction. I'm not like a massive fantasy fiction person. I've read like 5 or 6 fantasy series in my time, but fools, especially when it's medieval type fantasy, fools often take on a kind of like super mystical quality. And instead of just being an object of or a person of fun in these novels, they often take on a kind of sinister, or like in the Assassin's Apprentice, the fool has some kind of prescience, sees the future, but it doesn't make sense, you know. And then later, when you think back on what they said, that actually all did make sense all along, kind of thing. Same through in Game of Thrones, in the Game of Thrones novels as well. There's a fool who didn't make it into the TV show, but similar kind of thing. So as soon as I saw the name of the track and the name of the artist, I thought, oh, this makes me think of fantasy fiction. And then I listened to the track and I thought, it really makes me think of fantasy fiction. Do you think that's a reasonable connection between things I've made there, or do you think that's a bit of a stretch?
No, I think that's definitely fair. I mean, this is from an album that's called Tarot Part 1. As well, so there's definitely a lot of that kind of stuff going on.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've given it the big intro. Should we just give it a listen?
Yes, indeed.
Here we go. So this is The Fool by Magic Brother and Mystic Sister. Thank you. the really, really long fade out. Really long. I mean, I'm talking like 40 second fade out. It's still going. I feel bad talking over the top of it a little bit. But now it's just the sound of a cold autumnal wind. Still going. Okay, just ringing the last few seconds out of the full. Okay, so Magic Brother and Mystic Sister are a psych band.
That is fair to say. Absolutely.
Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted that confirmation from you.
I needed that 40 seconds to compose myself after witnessing the girth of Andre 3000's drone flute. Wowee.
I text you a lot of pictures of people just earnestly blowing on a Toyota whacking drone flute. And yeah. Do you know what I mean? You know what I'm saying?
Ooh, absolutely. Yeah.
Anyway, back to these guys. So they're from Barcelona.
They are.
I don't know why they keep saying things and just long pause. They're from Barcelona. The psych band, and this track has a nice propulsive like bass drum rhythm section that's pushing the whole track forward. This is not a track massively worried about melody, I wouldn't say. It's more about vibe, more about scene setting. Would you say that, or would you not agree with that?
No, I definitely agree with that. Absolutely, I've had something very similar in my notes actually. Yeah, because this is like the opening track on the album, and it is, as you say, it's kind of like a vibe. Yeah, scene set is a good way of putting it. Yeah, not necessarily a song.
No,
but lots of elements that I like. So, as I say, this is from an album that's just come out called Tarot Part One. So there is a part two coming. Very soon, I believe, and it's a follow up that's been a little time coming to their debut record. So the debut record was an album that I discovered. I think I would have discovered it on Instagram or on some kind of blog or something like that. And it was one of those kind of cool little records that I just really took to, and it was one of those ones that I bought, and through sharing it, people just. It was one of those ones I posted a couple of times throughout the year, and people were just like kind of really quite taken with it. And it was one of those one cool ones where everybody that kind of checked it out just really liked it and bought it. And yeah, just one of those kind of like cool cult records that you know, I felt like I had a little bit of a hand, a very small hand, and just like kind of like turning people onto, which was cool. And I liked that about it. That was a really cool debut. The fourth track on that album was called Yogi Tea, and there was something kind of very kind of warming and pungent and fatally intoxicating about the whole thing, like you would get with a nice cup of chai.
And they're
named after a song by the group Gong, who are, you know, kind of very kind of hippie prog group. And there's one track that's got an excerpt from Timothy Leary's trippy set text, The Psychedelic Experience. So it's all those kind of psychedelic signifiers that you kind of recognise, but I enjoy. There was also an abundance of flute. There was just flute everywhere, and it was psych, but it was kind of pulling from that kind of late 60s, early 70s. Period where psych and prog were kind of mixing, so there was a lot of kind of like Caravan in there, post Sid, pre Dark Side Floyd. Is that kind of period where they went a bit kind of bucolic, Pink Floyd. So really, really cool vibe to that record, and it's quite interesting with this album because it feels like they're kind of going backwards a little bit in time, because this to me feels maybe more kind of mid to late 60s. There's a lot of like phase guitars, bubble bass, lots of sitar, not necessarily on this track, but other tracks. I saw one online poster that suggested that one particular sitar stroke track sounded like Cooler Shaker. And they said it as a compliment. Which I thought was quite funny. So there's a lot of that kind of type of sight going on here. as well as a lot of that kind of, as you're saying, the kind of fantastical stuff that's going on there and the kind of mystical stuff. I'm not sure the songs are as strong this time around. I think, you know, as I say, this song kind of works as a scene setter, but even the songs after this maybe aren't as strong as the ones on the debut. Maybe I have to give it more time. But, you know, it's a kind of general sound and things that I like. I'm kind of compelled to quite enjoy this project, even if this album itself is maybe not as strong as the debut for me.
I'm tempted to pull down from my imaginary shelf here, my imaginary book of like Ian's podcast cliches, because I'm about to drop them all on you right now. Yeah. One is, oh, look, Andrew, it's psychedelic music, so you must really like it. That's one.
Yeah.
I think I've already covered that. And then I know this is quite a good example of modern psychedelic music, but kind of what's the point? Because all psychedelic music sounds like this forever. So I've trot out that one as well. What I do like about this is, here's a stat for you. In the last month, Magic Brother and Mystic Sister have amassed 1,426 listens on Spotify. Listeners, not lessons, listeners on Spotify. So this is not like a world-eating like musical project here. This is probably quite a mom and pop type thing. And I always have to say, I give massive respect to people who are like, I'm going to dedicate myself to music to the extent that I will do it as my career, right? But I will make absolutely no attempt to make music that will generally be liked by the buying public. I think that's really cool and really brave. Yeah. This is not going to like make them massively famous, I don't think. I don't mean that as a criticism. They probably don't give a shit about that. But it's a ballsy move. And you know, there's like loads of bands that you've never heard of, loads and loads, who are just touring around Europe and touring around the world. And you see them in venues like, I mean, I don't know if they've played in Glasgow or not, but if they played in Glasgow, I imagine they're playing places like the Hug and Pint and so on. So not the big venues, but the kind of small, cool venues. They're doing the thing. And listen, I'm not going to listen to that record, I'm sorry. I'm just not. But that track itself, like, does the business. It does.
It's cool, right?
It does what it sets out to do on the old Care Mode. There's another one of mine. The old Care Mode ometer of, does it do what it sets out to do? It absolutely does. Yeah. So I think we can look into the future and we can envision a Tarot Part 2 somewhere down the line. Is this a long record, Tarot Part 1?
Not especially. It's about 40 minutes, something like that.
All right, okay.
So not too bad.
Okay, fair enough. Right, so there we go. Five very diverse new tracks this week. We had some avant folk, and then we had, I don't even know what to say about what we had after that. How would you describe what we had after that?
Yeah, hypnagogic pop is the thing.
Pop. And then we had something indie and kind of retro and kind of modern, an English teacher. We had something jazzy and new wave in Chewbacca, and then we had something absolutely retro psychedelic from Magic Brother and Mystic Sister. So a very diverse set of tracks today. So Andrew, thank you for that. Fed my brain a lot this week. Did enjoy that. Actually, although I know we're supposed to record earlier in the week, I actually enjoyed spending a little longer with all of those. They were all worth a bit extra time. So good selection. Okay, so I'm not going to give you the big intro. I did my spiel about buying coffee at the start of the podcast. So as everyone knows, now we're going to have the final word, where Andrew lifts down from his actual record collection something that he feels matches up, sometimes pretty neat and on the nose and sometimes just a little bit more vague, but something that matches up with what we've listened to today from the old record collection. So Andrew, the final word after you.
Thank you. Yeah, so we've obviously talked about Chewbacca, we've talked about Andre 3000. I thought we'd play us out today with a modern flute master, who is a guy called Tendelonius. So Tendelonius has done a lot of kind of really cool modern jazz projects. There's ones that are a little bit maybe more traditional in terms of jazz. So he plays with a group called Ruby Rushton, who are really great. And he's got his own 22 Orchestra, which is this kind of amorphous ensemble of kind of musicians that he plays with. But as well as that, he also does these kind of interesting EPs where he kind of branches out into kind of other areas of music. So the record that I've chosen to play us out with today is a record called On Flute, which came out in 2016. It's had a couple of represses. The repress I've got is, I think, from 2020. And it's just been repressed again a couple of weeks ago. And I'd really recommend people checking it out. It's kind of one of those ones that's now considered a bit of a modern classic already. It's kind of got that status to it. And on the record, Tendelonious is kind of incorporating broken beats, incorporating tribal rhythms on it. There's a really cool track that opens a record called Ghana that's just really frenetic and colourful. The track that I've chosen to play us out with is a really cool track, kind of whoop-inducingly fantastic, I would suggest. It's called Song for My Father. And it's him kind of going into like a house banger direction. Something that maybe like Todd Terje would do. So I just thought it'd be a cool way to play this out this week. Just kind of having it almost.
Taking care of business to go full circle on the whole thing. Listen, I never listened to the vinyl word in advance. Sometimes it's something I've heard before, but I never listened to it in advance. And I had no concept you were about to say this is a banger. I thought this was going to be some jazzy flute stuff. Well,
it's pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Pretty cool. All right. Cool, guys. Thank you so much. Thanks for being with us. We're a little bit late delivering this week, but we'll be back real soon.
See you soon, guys. Thank you.